You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Generation Gaza. Veteran war correspondent Janine DiGiovanni revisits Gaza and finds resilience and hope among its 2 million Palestinian residents, two-thirds of whom are under the age of 25. With photographs by Fatima Schber. Opening photo, Making Waves. Video storyteller and social media influencer Asma El-Khaldi of the Gaza Sky Geeks Consortium walks along the beach in Gaza City. Gaza's latest conflagration back in May was ruthless, deadly, and somehow inevitable after Israeli police tried to expel longtime Arab residents from East Jerusalem. Palestinian demonstrators took to the streets in Gaza, the West Bank, and Israel itself. Jewish settlers marched in response. When violence spread to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, one of the holiest sites in Islam, Israeli security forces clamped down, using rubber bullets and stun grenades on worshippers. There was a global chorus of indignation. Soon Hamas and the group Palestine Islamic Jihad sent cascades of rockets onto Israeli settlements, the first major escalation since 2014. Israel, concerned for the security of its citizens, 13 of whom would be killed, answered with a sustained bombing campaign, pounding Gaza brutally for 11 days. The result? 261 people dead, according to the UN, 130 of them civilians, of whom 67 were children. On one day, May 16, 2021, on one street, Al-Wada, 44 people were killed. Both sides were taken to task. Hamas, some said, had needlessly escalated the conflict by resorting to rockets. The Israelis, others argued, started it, and then did the inexcusable with an excessive and relentless use of force in their assault on the citizens of Gaza. Under the scrutiny of social media, Israel seemed to have crossed a dangerous new threshold, prompting condemnation far and wide, from Western capitals to the halls of Congress. Whatever the case, the nightmarish carousel of retaliation came, as it always had, with a chilling and unpredictable frequency. Indeed, local school children can track the armed confrontations like clockwork, as if reciting their math tables. 1987, 2000, the first and second uprisings, referred to as the Intifadas. 2008, the first Gazan war, followed by three subsequent Israeli military engagements in Gaza. Those school children, they were part of the very same bright-eyed generation that many viewed as the Palestinians' best hope. But hopes here are often dashed. As the months went on, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict would be supplanted in the news cycle by other wars and flare-ups, and the young people remained in place. In fact, nowhere in the Middle East were Arab youths more continually confined and concentrated than in the Gaza Strip, the 7-mile-wide, 25-mile-long stretch of Mediterranean land adjacent to Israel, that is home to some 2 million Palestinians, two-thirds of them under the age of 25. This confinement is part of a crippling siege imposed by Israel and neighboring Egypt, resulting in untold privations and a restriction of movement that amounts to perpetual detention. Gaza's 20- and 30-somethings, it so happens, tend to be highly educated, multilingual, and jobless. 64% of the youth labor force is unemployed, largely due to the occupation. Nonetheless, year after year, they have proved tireless. I came to Gaza this past summer to find out how and why. I met with young entrepreneurs and farmers, artists and actors, environmental activists and computer coders, athletes and academics. With many women, I talked about their being powerful change agents in a male society. And everyone I encountered spoke not only about their sense of claustrophobia and fear, but also about their pride in what they've sought to accomplish in the tiny tinderbox they call home. I have been reporting from Gaza for more than 30 years. I arrived in 1989 during the first intifada, which began in a Gaza refugee camp and spiraled into a six-year rebellion against the Israeli occupation, lasting until the historic 1993 signing of the first Oslo Accord between Israeli and Palestinian leaders. The first intifada was nicknamed the Revolution of Stones because young street protesters used slingshots against gun-toting Israeli soldiers. In those days, I sat on the floor with children at the Gaza Community Mental Health Program with a visionary doctor called Ayed El-Siraj and asked them to draw pictures of their lives. Without prompting, they made sketches of stick figure people taking their fathers away in the night, or planes dropping bombs. Even though these children rarely cried, I will never forget that many had the thousand-yard stare that I would later see in young soldiers in conflicts I covered, sometimes for Vanity Fair, in Afghanistan and the Balkans, Rwanda and Somalia, Iraq and Syria. The tragedy, it turned out, was that these deeply traumatized children, or the teenage stone throwers I met years ago, would become the same grown-ups who now comfort their own children during bombing raids. At times, I have found myself interviewing the sons or daughters of people I encountered two generations back. This is a forbidding cycle of transgenerational trauma. Next photo, no exit. Night descends on Gaza City, urban center of the Gaza Strip. There is also an agonizing sense of wistfulness, of a people conscious of a world outside that they can never see or experience. Many Gazans have never even been to Erez, the crossing point between Israel and Gaza's northern point, which has grown into an airport-style terminal. As for Hamas, the militant organization that governs Gaza, and which the U.S. and Europe have designated as promoting terrorism, most people are frustrated with the leadership, yet the population's options are limited. Speaking out against Hamas or the Palestinian Authority, PA, the entrenched, largely corrupt party that oversees much of the West Bank, is dangerous, and trying to forge new young Palestinian leaders can be perilous. Last June, Nizar Banat, a Palestinian activist who frequently criticized the PA and was cited as a future change agent, died in unnatural circumstances while in PA custody, according to a local justice minister. His family has accused the PA of assassinating him. In short, the people of Gaza, young and old, are at a fourfold disadvantage. The PA frequently exercises collective punishment on all Gazans because they are effectively under the rule of Hamas, which is waging an ongoing battle with the PA. Hamas has not effectively governed or been able to provide basic public services for years. Israel imposes its own harsh restrictions on those who live in the territories, and Gaza's closest Arab neighbor, Egypt, often treats it with disdain. This all leads to a debilitating collective impotence. There's a sense of constant helplessness, says Yasser Abu Jumai, a Gazan psychiatrist. They have disappointment for many reasons, but mainly it's about the human rights violations that are happening. Why is humanity watching and doing nothing? It makes Palestinians feel more pain. The late Ron Schlichler, a diplomat and former U.S. Consul General to Jerusalem, once said, "You Israelis can do all sorts of things to the Palestinians, but you won't buy them and you won't break them." Not a chance. Not the members of Gaza's generations Y, Z, and Alpha. Next photos, True Grit. Raji El-Jarou, founder of the rock band Osprey V. Former Abdullah Abu Halima in Beit Lahia with irrigation pipes damaged in May's Israeli bombardment. Hanid Khaled, actor with the Theater Day project. One morning, I met Rosen Wasim Akhazindar, 36, in her pink and green atelier on the fifth floor of a modern building in Gaza City, high enough to block out the noise from the street below. A designer and brand influencer, she is married with two children and leads a team of more than 20 hipsters. They sat in front of MacBooks with cups of half-drunk coffee by their sides, working on websites and logos. Many of the men sported Brooklyn-esque facial hair. A few of the women had no studs. It could have been Bushwick, Austin, or Seattle. "It's a safe space," Al-Khazindar said, leading the way past a large goldfish tank, artificial grass walls, and a fully stocked kitchen for her staff. "Kids are welcome." Her son Zane, 12, sat in a corner, absorbed in a computer game. There was an area for freelancers, a kind of Palestinian WeWork that the company provides for free, along with laptops and seed money. Part of Al-Khazindar's mission is philanthropic. She trains apprentices until they are ready to join her team. She sipped fresh mango juice and had on skinny jeans, moccasins, and a blouse emblazoned with rhinestones. Open, effusive, and sunny, she wore a yellow and gold butterfly necklace as a symbol of freedom, she explained, her personal logo. She had clearly overcome the two major strikes against her, being a woman and a Gazan. Despite having graduated with a degree in computer science and later studying coding in Egypt, she wound up getting secretarial work, fetching coffee. "All my life, I was told, 'You're just a girl, you can't do it,'" she recalled. "There I was, a trained scientist, running errands for men." She managed to land a UN job, where she met her husband and settled in to raise a family, but she felt thwarted. Everything was pink and nice. I was watching TV and gossiping with my mother. It was a low point. Al-Khazindar studied YouTube videos and shifted her focus from computer coding to design. Slowly, she built a business printing patterns on fabric, mugs, and T-shirts, imprinted with Go Girl slogans like "You are the power." She met with strong opposition from her family and friends, who said her husband would leave her to find another wife. She shrugged them off, found a bigger workspace, recruited brighter young people, and kept working. "Gazans are people who fight, and I am a striver," she declared. "We keep going." Striving is a good way to describe young Gazans. Many I know speak perfect, nuanced English, and usually another European language or two, which they have picked up online. They are curious, vibrant, hardworking, but also slammed by the fact that they cannot export their products, get money in and out of Gaza, or procure basic materials. Venmo doesn't work, nor do bank transfers, or even Amazon. Obstacles are everywhere. "Try buying a new Apple charger for your MacBook Air in Gaza," Al-Khazindar said. "Impossible." Many young Gazans get postgraduate invitations from elite European or Ivy League universities, but can't secure exit visas to make their visa appointments at American embassies. If they stay, the job market is unimaginably competitive, One young dentist lamented the fact that after his graduation ceremony from Gaza's Al-Aqsa University, there were 7 graduates for 1 opening. One afternoon, I drove out to Kuzas, a remote farming region in the middle of the strip near Khan Yunis. Passing cactus trees and unpaved roads, I pulled up to a simple concrete house. On the front porch sat 2 of the 3 green girls, an all-female agricultural project. Asil Al-Najjar and Gaida Kudai, the 3rd partner, Nadine Ruck, was not around, are university grads who couldn't find work in their fields, accounting and computer science, respectively. So in 2020, they attempted to grow their future out of the very soil, drawing on their families to teach them vital skills. Nearly 80% of university graduates are unemployed in Gaza, even before the pandemic, Al-Najjar told me, but we still dreamt of having our own income. Ruck's father, a farmer, taught them how to grow vegetables, and they began to deliver them by bicycle. They rented 3 dunams of land, less than an acre, and planted peas, lettuce, and radishes. They plan on expanding to the frozen food market. But their list of grievances is long. Israeli border closures limit travel for their professional development or for obtaining crucial materials like fertilizer. They feel unsafe being so close to Israel proper. Kudai pointed to a nearby border fence and a looming watchtower, and they claimed that herbicide spraying from Israel had damaged their crops. Walking through their greenhouses, they spoke of their lack of support and the weight of feeling isolated, but they insist they are not giving up. Sarah Roy, an associate at Harvard Center for Middle Eastern Studies and the child of 2 Holocaust survivors, has worked in Gaza for 4 decades. In books and articles, she has dived deep into this sense of isolation while examining Gaza's financial fissures. She identified a syndrome of de-development in Gaza, a process that rids an economy of much of its productive capacity and deprives its workers of the building blocks needed to build a strong economic base. In the Gaza Strip, Roy told me, there is an economy, if one can still call it that, that is unviable, unable to function rationally and normally. And the long-term consequence, she stressed, is the untapped potential. Imagine if Gazans put all the energy and creativity they now expend on survival. Finding menial employment, feeding their children, securing clean water, into productive activities. Gaza is a closed place, added Dalia Sharab, a 30-year-old with an undergraduate degree in physics, who runs Mompreneur, a mentoring program for women. She had been overseeing 66 all-female projects, including one that develops car batteries. But shortly after the May bombings, she left Gaza for Jordan. Now she monitors the startup ventures remotely. I want to raise my kids in a healthy environment. In 2018, Sharab got a taste of the outside world during a fellowship in Silicon Valley, where she worked with Google. It was my first time out of Gaza, the first time I took a train, the first time I took a bus. The experience left her hungry for greater knowledge, which, in her view, is sorely limited in Gaza. You can't get out if you want an educational exchange, to learn new tech, for instance, to update your skills. If you stay inside, the government, Hamas, is controlling the education, and they are too lazy to update the curriculum. But Asma Abu Mazied, a 33-year-old economics and gender advisor working in Gaza, said the situation can't be blamed entirely on Hamas. Usually, when we speak about our suffering, she maintained, Hamas is used as a boogeyman to internalize the economic collapse rather than holding the occupation accountable. But the occupation is the cause, the main contributor to the economic deterioration of the Gaza Strip. Abu Mezied is also anxious about young Gazans like Shirab immigrating. She made the case that the brain drain is systematic on Israel's part, an attempt to get rid of the best minds. She asked grimly, how about flying us all to Mars? It would have the same result. Education is the cornerstone for progress here, and the Palestinian concept of sumud, steadfastness, is paramount. Gazans have a deep commitment to learning and one of the strongest senses of family that I have ever witnessed. Together, these attributes are formidable. In the local refugee camps, for example, where there is scant privacy and little electricity by which to study, parents make huge efforts to help their children earn top grades so they can get into the best universities. Brian K. Barber, a social psychologist and international security fellow at the think tank New America, has studied in Gaza for years. He told me that Gazans' academic achievement is extraordinary, not necessarily despite their circumstances, but because of them. Achievement is in part defensive. So, you tell us we're nothing, worthless? We'll show you. Having long charted a Palestinian youths as they have grown through adulthood, Barber believes that identity, learning, and morality are all of a piece in the social mindset here. A good person, he explained, is often defined as someone who achieves as much education as possible, cares for and extends his or her family, and finds personalized ways of supporting the cause. Education brings esteem from the culture and is the only perceived avenue to secure a positive future. One day, I stopped in at Sunbox in Gaza City, which provides affordable off-grid solar panels to families. A brilliant civil engineer, Majd Masharari, 28, founded the company in 2017 because she got fed up with having to study throughout college by candlelight, a result of the persistent power outages. Masharari's goal was to help the local population become less dependent on Israel for electricity. But she wanted power to be accessible to everyone, not just wealthy Gazans. So she offered a pay-as-you-go option for those who couldn't afford the startup kit. Her other tech firm, Greencake, manufactures eco-friendly construction materials to help rebuild Gazan homes and other structures after repeated bombings. When I arrived at the tiny office on Halabi Street, Masharari was not there. She had recently immigrated with her family to Saudi Arabia. Her brother Kamal and the chief engineer, Mohammed Almazani, both educated in the U.S., we're closing up after a day's work. In impeccable English, Kamal told me, the biggest challenge for entrepreneurs here is the political situation. We can wake up one day to news that there's another war. Everything gets closed down, and it may last for months, as it did in 2014. The other issue is the damaged economy. You can't rely on or make plans to grow because of the illogical policies imposed by Hamas, Israel, or Egypt. Most entrepreneurs fail within the first 5 years because of that. There is no winning. My colleagues and I are dancing on the brink, said Abu Mezied with a tone of resignation. She spoke over the din of a distribution truck, dispensing drinking water in the aftermath of the bombings, which had damaged pipes and facilities. In the 100-degree heat, the truck's sound system was incongruously blasting jingle bells. That's how we young people perceive Gaza. We are always one step away from falling, yet we are not living. A constant falling state. That sense of one step forward, two steps back is ever present. Abdullah Abu Halima, 33, is a farmer in Beit Lahia on the northern tip of Gaza, whose life was altered forever that May. Armed with a degree in information systems from Al-Azhar University, he had a dream to grow more diverse crops in Gaza, regardless of the impediments, such as limited water and the dwindling availability of usable farmland. Studying alternative farming methods including successful Israeli ones, Abu Halima borrowed $120,000 in 2020 to buy 48 solar panels and install 8,200 meters of hydroponic pipes. It was a big project and a big risk, but he reckoned that by using an innovative solar-powered irrigation system, he could maximize water usage, plant several different crops, and make seasonal organic vegetables available all year. Child of Dune, my lifetime passion project, managed to survive the upheaval of all Hollywood. Now let's talk Trilogy by Denis Villeneuve. As Dune neared its release last year, one of my brothers found a part of its origin in a drawer in my parents' home. They were drawings I'd made with my friend Nicholas Kadima, storyboards for a movie we envisioned after reading Frank Herbert's novel. I was probably 13 or 14 years old. We were nerds. Other boys were playing football, but we were writing screenplays. Directors were our gods: Steven Spielberg, Ridley Scott, George Lucas, Martin Scorsese. It's fun to think that when we were boys, we were already dreaming about this. Back then, dreaming was all we could do. I grew up in a small village in Quebec in the early 80s, and we didn't have the resources to actually make movies, even homemade ones. We did some short Super 8 films, but that came later. In Canada, I was told that only crazy people made movies. It was not considered a real job. It was something very far away from us. Maybe too far. I spent decades imagining Dune, several years actually writing and creating it, and another excruciating year when it couldn't be released because of the pandemic. The full journey has taken most of my life. I expected to go into science. I loved biology and mathematics and was a good student. Still, I was fascinated by the art of filmmaking and storytelling. My heart was split in half. My favorite book was one about the human body, which explained things like the science of what happens between the brain and the muscles when you pinch your fingers together. For me, that is sci-fi. I deeply love the science of life, which is probably why Dune resonated with me so deeply. Herbert was a journalist, and his novel was inspired by reporting he did on a coastal community in Oregon where sand dunes were encroaching, driven by intense ocean winds. I grew up by the St. Lawrence River, a very quiet, melancholic place. It wasn't a desert, but the vast horizon dominated there as well. There were two man-made structures that stood out. One was the church, the other a nuclear power plant, about 3 miles from our home. I fixated on those two towers, science and religion, both linked by faith. The same ideas are woven throughout Dune. I grew up to have a successful film career in Canada. After the release of my first English-language film, 2013's Prisoners, people began to ask me what my dream project would be. The only thing that came to my mind was Dune. In 2016, while I was working on Blade Runner 2049, I heard that the rights to Herbert's novel were available. When I was doing promotion for Arrival at the Venice Film Festival later that year, I said, very loudly and clearly, that I wanted to make Dune. Mary Parent, the production head at Legendary Entertainment, was acquiring the rights, and the ink was still drying on the contract when she read about my dreams in the press. We met for 45 seconds, I think. We just looked at each other and said, let's do this. Sometimes it takes many years, but then the thing you've hoped for happens all at once. Bringing Dune to life was extremely challenging for everyone involved, but shooting in the desert together created a strong bond between us. It was quite magical, a real adventure. Everybody gave their best. Then we were isolated by the pandemic, finalizing post-production on a movie that would ultimately be delayed for nearly a year. That part was unavoidable. It was about safety for the audience. But soon after, we encountered a disruption that was made by choice. In December 2020, Warner Brothers announced that its entire upcoming film slate would debut simultaneously on its streaming service, HBO Max. I heard the news just before it was announced, and I was so destabilized that I didn't know how to react. Then the anger came. I was asked to stay quiet, but I saw friends like Christopher Nolan speaking publicly, and I felt it was my duty. I spoke out partly for my own sanity, because it's never good to keep anger to yourself. I wrote an open letter and received feedback from all over the world. There's a lot of love out there for cinema and for theaters. At the end of the day, the enemy was the pandemic. Growing up in that remote village, I saw some movies on big screens, but the theaters were far from home. So as a young kid, I saw 2001: A Space Odyssey for the first time on TV. The same with the first Planet of the Apes and the original Blade Runner, too. Discovering cinema on TV meant that I was watching movies that were terrible copies, washed out, oversaturated, distorted. When I finally saw the masterpieces in a theater, they had a far greater impact. Dune was a dream designed and shot for the big screen. Streaming is not as bad as a poorly transferred TV broadcast, but it is still a shrinking of something meant to be overwhelming and immersive. There are too many things that you lose launching movies on TV. I understand that for Wall Street, the theaters are a roller coaster, that it's not a stable business, that it's a risky business. And I appreciate streaming because it allows us to revisit films that we loved or go back in film history. It's fantastic for archives. But movies dreamed and made for the big screen need to be born on the big screen. Cinema is an art form that needs an audience. It's still difficult for me to process that Dune was released on TV at the same time that it debuted in theaters. We still did good numbers, theatrically, but what saved us was that the word of mouth was strong and that people were tired of being at home. We are not meant to be isolated. We are meant to be together. Dune arrived at just the right moment. I must add that I've been comforted by the fact that outside the U.S., the movie was shown exclusively in theaters. The success means we get to make the second movie, which means we'll be able to complete the second half of Herbert's novel. That film will debut exclusively in theaters. It's part of the deal. I'm finishing the screenplay now, and we expect to be shooting by summer, which is practically tomorrow morning. With the first half of Dune, the toughest part was introducing the world and laying down the rules. Now, just the fun of the story is left. I'm always very cautious discussing movies that are in the making. They're full of fragile ideas. But the second one will definitely be more visual and less dialogue-driven. And hopefully, there will be another film after that. Dune Messiah, Herbert's second novel in this universe, would make total sense as a third movie because it completes Paul Atreides' arc. I want to make part two as fast as possible. Then I will wait a few years until Timothy Chalamet gets a bit older to do the final installment. I've lived with Dune for most of my life. Being patient is part of the journey. This article was written as told to Anthony Bresnikan. Ghost in the Machine by Mark Rosso, with opening illustration by Jorge Arevalo, which shows musicians all playing separately, wearing headphones. The streaming revolution is changing the way film composers get paid and exposing the flaws of a system where big names farm their scores out to uncredited ghost composers. Now the artists actually writing the music are demanding recognition and a fair share of the profits. Creating music in 21st century Hollywood as a composer for an Emmy-winning cable series, put it, feels like an underground, a real pimp situation. He talked about long hours, low pay, and working under a martinet lead composer, his boss, who delegated the actual work of writing and recording. One time he had a meltdown because the director was coming to hear what he had come up with, and he didn't have anything to play him, the composer went on, because my computer had all the music on it, and it was on the fritz. He laughed, c'est la guerre, but the irritation and dismay were palpable. Another Hollywood composer summed up the widespread feeling among the men and women who do the day-to-day work of bending melody, harmony, and rhythm to match pictures on a movie or television screen. There's no contract. There's no union. You're completely beholden to working with someone who's completely unethical or not. The ultimate perquisite of a composer's life, said Henry Mancini, is being able to make a living doing what you truly love to do, create music. Mancini, who scored such films as Breakfast at Tiffany's, The Pink Panther, and Victor Victoria, winning 4 Oscars along the way, belongs to an all-time pantheon of film composers that includes Bernard Herrmann, John Williams, and more recently Hans Zimmer. We don't talk about film composers much, but their work is essential to the cinematic experience. Try to imagine Psycho without Herrmann's stabbing violins, or Inception without Zimmer's gut-rattling brum. As the director James Cameron once put it, the score is the heart and soul of a film. Lately, in the streaming era, composers themselves are talking more and more about making a living. With an increasing share of their work moving to streaming, film composers are seeing their royalty earnings dwindle to pennies on the dollar. As more than 36 of them put it last August, in an open letter to ASCAP, BMI, and the other performance royalty organizations, or PROs, that collect and distribute revenues to songwriters. This raises serious concerns for the future financial outlook for all composers, the letter declared. Worse still, some streamers, most notably Netflix, are defaulting to work agreements that cut out royalties entirely. Such agreements are known as buyouts, work-for-hire deals that offer a lump payment and no back end, and they deprive the composer of any share in the ongoing success of a hit series or movie. In 2019, a group of award-winning composers, including Carter Burwell, who has written the score for nearly every Coen Brothers movie, Joel Beckerman, CBS This Morning, John Powell, the Jason Bourne franchise, and Pinar Toprak, Captain Marvel, launched Your Music, Your Future, an initiative aimed at raising awareness about buyouts. So far, nearly 19,000 people have signed on. As these new financial pressures mount, they are exposing cracks in the system of film composing itself. There's rising disenchantment with a system in which paying dues has come to resemble abasement, with aspiring composers working on the cheap without benefits, security, or the leverage of a composer's union, if only one existed. Once upon a time, it did. The Composers and Lyricists Guild of America, founded in the 1950s, disbanded after a 1971 strike. Much of the resentment traces back to film composing's biggest open secret. Many of its brightest stars do not, in fact, write the music they are celebrated and remunerated for. That work, or a good bit of it, is delegated to others. Sometimes those others are credited as additional composers, but often they are gig workers, effectively, who receive modest pay and no credit. Such shadow contributors are known as ghost composers, and the debate over how name-brand music directors get paid is haunted by their existence. Last summer, Scarlett Johansson's lawsuit against Disney for opening Black Widow simultaneously in theaters and on its streaming platform, a decision she claimed cost her millions in box office royalties, revealed widespread anxiety about compensation in rapidly digitizing Hollywood. The suit was settled last September. Terms were not disclosed. Likewise, composers have been nervous as they see venerable ways of doing things change. The new economics of streaming are threatening what is essentially a quasi-feudal system. Composers might not at all be happy about that system, but they worry it will be replaced with something more dire. There's a secretiveness to it all that's strange, one composer told me, on condition of anonymity. There's a world everyone sees, and then you look under the hood. Many of the people contacted for this story, composers, lawyers, music supervisors, requested anonymity, fearful that they might jeopardize career opportunities by speaking openly about how their business works. The vibe is, the first rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club. Which is perhaps why a series of tweets the veteran composer Joe Kramer, Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, posted last year ricocheted throughout the composing community. I can count the number of mainstream Hollywood composers that I know write all their music themselves on one hand, John Williams being the most famous example, Kramer wrote. Everyone else is a team leader, a figurehead for a team of composers. Williams has described his methodology, which is not all that different from the way Brahms would have done it. While composing, I'm scribbling with a pen and throwing pages all over the room. He makes music with the most traditional of tools, a Steinway and staff paper. His orchestrations are, as he has said, articulated down to the last harp. Williams is the image of the composer, a solitary artist, that most of us hold in our heads. He is an industry paragon. It's even said that directors sometimes work around his music rather than the other way around. The Williams approach, as Kramer noted, is exceedingly rare these days. As the Hollywood composer I spoke with put it, the name brands have had people write their music for 20-plus years. A veteran Hollywood music supervisor described how it works. The composers have 6 or 7 projects on the go at any point, he said, referring to lead composers working in television. The leader sets the tonal palette to get them going, and then the minions do the actual writing. Let's say you're one of these minions, an additional composer or a studio assistant who is allowed to write, and you're working on the score of a tentpole movie with a major film music studio. You're assigned a number of cues, bits of the score that you will compose to accompany specific scenes. The lead composer, whose name will go on the final product, has worked up the overall direction. Zimmer calls it the sketch. As Devo founder turned film composer Mark Mothersbaugh, Rugrats, the Lego Movie, and 4 Wes Anderson films once described it, you give them themes, you do a rough mock-up, and then those people fine-tune it all. In some ways, it's a system that resembles the assembly line studios of contemporary artists, such as Mark Kustabi and Jeff Koons. As a fine-tuner, you write the actual music for your assigned cues and submit demos to the lead composer's studio. Then comes a process of feedback and approval, followed by the actual recording, which could mean an orchestra. To put film scoring into culinary terms, the cues you've written go into a soup, the score, created by many fellow sous chefs, additional composers, working under an executive chef, the lead composer. Part of the idiosyncratic beauty of a Hollywood film score, as the Hollywood composer I spoke to phrased it, is its cool collaborative aspect, a handed-down-the-line feel. When the term clicks, there is a shared sense of energy and enterprise. For many young composers, it's what draws them to Hollywood as opposed to Carnegie Hall. If their contributions end up being credited, usually as additional composer, and the pay is decent, the participants can be quite happy. They can pay the rent. They might someday rise to the level of lead composer, as did John Powell, Henry Gregson Williams, and Lauren Balfe. Brilliant film scorers all, coming out of Zimmer's behemoth remote control studio in Santa Monica. The minions there are sometimes referred to as Zimlings. And then there are the ghost composers. As much as ghost composing is virtually unknown among the movie-going public, it enjoys a long tradition as an entry-level rite of passage. One of the gods of film scoring, Ennio Morricone, was a ghost composer before earning his first credit on a feature in 1961. "I've been a ghost myself on really big movies," Zimmer has noted. Occasionally, the issue of ghost composing pops up in the media, as when, in 2014, the deaf Japanese composer Mamoru Samurgochi, a so-called digital-age Beethoven, was found to have employed a ghost composer for 18 years. It was regarded as a scandal. On the message boards of VI Control, an online composer community, the conversation inevitably veers toward ghost composing. "When I saw the composer site with his reel populated by the stuff I did 100% on it, I wanted to puke out of shame for that person," a poster called Audio Loco wrote last year. Another poster alluded to big-name composers accepting industry awards for music they didn't write. Ghost and additional composers speak of moments of almost comical awkwardness, as when a director, reviewing the score, marvels at a beautiful passage and exclaims to the name-brand guy who did not, in fact, write it, "Oh, we're so lucky to have you." The awkwardness is compounded when the actual, unacknowledged composer is sitting in the room. It's part of the frustration that ghost and additional composers feel. The world has no clue what they do. "You're not just arranging," the Hollywood composer said. "You're writing." The issue of payment can cause frustration, too. The composer on the Emmy Award-winning series told me that he got $150 up front per cue, the length of which can vary. He might spend as many as 10 hours on each one. "When you break it down, it's like minimum wage," he said. The fee for a cue can also fluctuate greatly. Depending on the project and the lead composer. One ghostwriter on big movies mentioned getting $1,500 per minute of music. When it comes to royalties, the veteran Hollywood music person told me the standard split with the lead composer is 50-50 per cue, even if the additional or ghost composer does all the work. After all, the lead composer is putting a roof over everybody's head. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.